Well, it's so great to be back at this amazing conference. And my goal for today is to tell you a little bit about what we've been up to over the last 16 years. We've been doing this for a while now. I'm going to summarize a couple of our important insights and tell you some new emerging problems and opportunities in cheese microbiology. And my lab is really interested not just in cheese, we're interested in fermented foods in general. So things like sourdough, kimchi, kombucha. And so some of these beautiful things that you can see here, of course, all of these have microbial communities in them. We're most familiar with the wonderful fuzzy and slimy surfaces of cheese, but kombucha, salami, we also are interested in Asian ferments like koji. All of these have microbial communities in them. And what we do in my lab is think a lot about how humans interact with fermented food microbiomes, both from a basic science perspective, right? How can we learn how do microbiomes form? How do microbial communities that you all have in your own guts right now, as well as we have in these foods, form and function? And how do they interact with our human microbiome? More and more, we're really interested in this space of practicing and crafting. So working with producers of fermented foods to ask questions about, you know, when a producer works in a fermented food environment, how are they actually shaping the ecology and evolution of food microbes? When a microbiome on a food fails, right? When you get a weird mold, when things get slimy, when things turn pink, why and how can we fix it? And I won't talk about it today, but I'm really interested in this idea of novel ferments. So most fermented foods that we have today are sort of happy accidents, right? Historically, someone let something rot. It was delicious. We ate it. Sometimes it wasn't delicious. People got sick. But along the way, we've kind of had these accidents. And now we have tools to more intentionally create novel fermentations. And I'm happy to chat more later about that. I'm also incredibly passionate about education. I think if we do all this great science and just keep it locked away in journals, it's useless, right? So bringing it out to the people who need it, I think, is really important, and I'll briefly mention some of the work that we're doing there. So let's go to the basic science first and think a little bit about what are the neat things we learn about how microbial communities work using fermented foods. And we think about this sort of in three steps, and this is useful if you're a cheesemaker, thinking about the microbes you're working with on a daily basis. The first thing we think about is where do they come from, right? All microbes in your cheese plant have to come from somewhere. Maybe it's from a starter culture that you buy in a packet. Maybe it's from having the windows open or having your cave air facilities bringing in fresh air. This is the process of dispersal in ecology. A lot of what we think about in my lab is thinking about interactions, right? So how do molds, bacteria, and yeasts in cheeses interact with each other? But also, how do they interact with the environment, right? You all have different sources of milk. You all use different types of salt. You all have different environments in your caves. And those interactions, abiotic interactions, are very important. And I'll tell you an incredibly cool story today about how, since we've been doing this for so long now, we can actually see microbes evolving in fermented foods, and specifically looking at how molds in cheese caves can evolve over a decade of cheese production. And so really, if you think about all three of these things together, you can capture the full dynamics, the ecology and evolution of a fermented food microbiome. We think about this, of course, mostly in cheese caves. So this is really where my heart lies. I love sauerkraut. I love kombucha. Those are great systems. But I love mold. And really, the most moldy and most interesting place to find molds would be in cheese caves. Everything from, you know, very highly manicured places like where we work up at Jasper Hill in Vermont to this lovely mucor-covered cheese here in eastern France that I got to see with Yvonne quite a long time ago on a trip in eastern France. And I don't have to tell you all what cheese rind microbiomes are, but really we're thinking about surface-ripened cheeses. We don't really do a lot of work with the paste. We really think about the microbiology on the rind. And as many of you know, that rind is the collection of a variety of different bacteria that we've been learning since Rachel Dutton and I started this work a long time ago, and yeasts, as well as a variety of different molds. And this is sort of a cartoon version. If you could see what they look like, this is what we think about in terms of that community of microbes. And really, it's been a long time that we've been working on this system, and what we've learned is that there's a limited diversity, right? 2 to maybe 12 species of these microbes that are living on a typical cheese rind. We can bring them from the cheese cave into the lab and play around with them in a very synthetic way. We call these synthetic communities. And the other thing we've learned, and this is the thing that I love since I'm a fungal biologist, it's really the fungi that control these systems. The bacteria and yeast are important. They're very important. But fungi, to me, they're like the beavers of the landscape, if you will, at the micro scale here. They are the keystone species in cheese rinds. And what do I mean by that? What are some examples? Well, we've found over the last decade a lot of different ways that those fungi, those molds, are really shaping the entire microbiome of cheese rinds. And that's everything from creating these physical scaffolds, these hyphae that you see, you know, the fuzzy shapes you see on the cheese rind. They can serve as ways that bacteria can move around, little superhighways. We found, and I'll talk really briefly about how fungi produce a whole suite of compounds, many of which we've never identified before, that are growing on your cheeses right now. And some of those can be antibiotics. We've also found that, you know, one thing I love is when you walk into a cheese cave, it smells amazing, right? There's all these different aromas, these volatile compounds. And we found that those are ways that microbes can actually interact indirectly with each other. So when you go into your cheese cave, you're sort of smelling and interacting with microbial communication. Another thing that we see over and over again is as that rind is developing, the microbes are really duking it out for resources. Just like plants and animals are trying to find food out in their natural environment, on that rind, a lot of microbes are looking for amino acids as that casein is being broken down. And then another thing that they're often looking for, we call them scarce metals. You could think about this as iron and other metals that might be hard to get at first, and they're really sort of trying to find different ways to get access to those. And these are many of the ways that fungi can shape that whole community. So let's just look at one quick example to think about the basic science. And this all started with a cheesemaker in California who didn't have a rind. She was trying to grow a rind on this Basque-style sheep's milk cheese, and she kept calling me and saying, my rind isn't forming, what's going on, Ben? And it turns out that she was growing this mold unintentionally, a penicillium, and what you can see in this picture here, there's this little ring here, and then beyond that ring, you'll see it's sort of white. So what the white is bacteria, and that little ring there is where the bacteria can't grow. It's kind of like Alexander Fleming's discovery of penicillin, where he got the mold on the plate, and there was no growth of the bacteria. We're like, this is really interesting, what's going on here? And what we found is that this penicillium mold at this California cheese was essentially inhibiting all the bacteria that normally like to live on a cheese rind. So staph, there's your Brevi or your B. linens, and other bacteria that are typically important on the cheese rind. It was essentially wiping them all out. And what we found is that when you look at how this mold shapes that community, if you just had the bacteria growing alone on a cheese, they all grow quite happily. But as soon as you add that mold into the community, you'll see here that most of the community becomes staph-dominated, those coagulase-negative staphs that make the early part of the cheese rind. And what's great is I could call up my fungal genetics and chemistry friends, Nancy Keller at the University of Wisconsin, and say, why? Like, what is this, right? What is the fungus actually making that's killing this bacterium? And it was a lot of work. It was actually 2 years of this one postdoc's life that she spent chasing this down. And I'm just showing this in one part of this slide here. But we ran into this compound called serotin, which hadn't really been characterized before, never found on cheese before. And serotins are known for fungi produce them in the environment to kill insects, to sort of protect themselves from predation from insects. And we found that this particular fungus is actually making serotin, and that was why it was inhibiting these bacteria. And you may say, that's really cool basic science, Ben. Why is this sort of useful? Well, what we found is that many fungi can make serotins. And so we've been telling our colleagues that work on plant pathogens, our colleagues that work in soil, our colleagues that work in a lot of other environments, to look to see if you have fungi making serotins, because they may be doing something quite similar as we're seeing in the cheese in terms of how they shape the bacterial community. So this is a really cool example of how cheese, an accident on cheese, can provide really cool basic science findings for folks working in other parts of microbiology. Okay, so another thing that we're really interested in is not just the microbes themselves, but what happens when you eat that microbiome, right? When you eat a sauerkraut, when you eat a kombucha, when you eat a surface-ripened cheese, it can get into your gut, and there are potential interactions between that food microbiome and your gut microbiome. And this is a new question for us. We've been thinking a lot about this in the context of fermented vegetables, but you could replace this picture of cabbage with cows and have your farm to food to gut connection be cheese. This is just an example from sauerkraut, where what's happening on the farm, the microbial ecology of the farm, can get transmitted through the production of the fermented food. And when you eat that live microbial community, those microbes can end up in your gut. And I know we're going to hear from Sabrina in a little bit about this, so I won't go into great detail. But we've been also thinking about this in my lab as well, in the context of fermented vegetables, but other foods as well. And there are many ways that this can work in a good way, right? All of those microbes that are living in fermented foods, can serve what we call a probiotic function, right? So when you eat those microbes from any fermented food, yogurt, kimchi, whatever it happens to be, this is the lining of your large intestine. These are little cells of the human. And all along that lining of your intestinal layer, you have your own microbiome. And those fermented food bacteria and fungi can interact with that microbial community. They may even directly interact with your own human gut cells and potentially change your immune system. There's a lot of exciting research happening in this space to understand when you consume these fermented food microbes, how are they changing your gut microbiome, and how are they potentially talking to your own gut microbiome cells? And again, I know Sabrina's going to talk about this, so I won't go into much more detail there. I will say that in addition to the positive benefits of the human food microbiome connection, there are some things that we're worried about. There are some concerns that we have in the context of fermented foods. One thing that I recently wrote an article about, I was concerned, so I decided to do some research and write an article, and that is the idea of antimicrobial resistance. So there are a lot of these genes that bacteria and other organisms can encode that make them resistant to antibiotics that are clinically useful, things like tetracycline and other drugs. And I had heard a lot of sort of rumbling about whether this is a problem in fermented foods, but I hadn't seen a great review, and I wrote this review article. And I'll tell you that after writing this review article, I'm not that concerned, because if you eat a leaf of kale or if you eat an apple, you could also consume these same kinds of microbes that have these antibiotic resistance genes. I think what is important is to recognize that this sort of farm-to-gut connection does exist in cheese and other fermented foods, and potentially in the future, if there are new antibiotic resistance genes and microbes floating around, we may need to be aware of this connection, right? I'm not aware of any documented case where someone ate a cheese or other fermented food that had an antibiotic resistance gene and then died because they couldn't use an antibiotic anymore to treat an infection. But I do think this is something that folks should be aware of. The other thing that I've become increasingly aware of is that there are some potential opportunistic pathogens that are rarely found in cheeses and other types of fermented foods. Something that we've done work on are coagulase negative staph species, and specifically Staphylococcus saprophyticus. This is a bacterium that is known to cause UTIs, and for a long time, people thought that food staph saprophyticus and human urinary tract infection staph saprophyticus were different. But recent work, including from genomes from my own lab, has found if you make a big family tree of the food, animal, and UTI isolates, they all kind of cluster together, suggesting again that there may be a link between consuming certain foods like salami or cheeses and acquiring staph saprophyticus in terms of having a urinary tract infection. Again, the links here are not very clear, but I think this is something to have on our radar. I will say that staph saprophyticus, we've found it in the rinds of cheeses before, but it's really rare. It's relatively uncommon, both in North America as well as throughout Europe. Okay, so that's some of the sort of basic science and thinking about how humans and fermented food microbiomes are connected. Let's think a little bit about the practicing and crafting. This is honestly the best days of work for me when I'm out in a cheese cave or when someone sends me a Franken cheese with weird things growing on it and I have to try to do a sort of like a CSI and figure it out. That's when I'm happiest. So let's talk a little bit about that space. And one of the things that, again, I think is the neatest thing that we've ever done in the lab, it was a total accident, I don't know what that means about my management style, is that we found the evolution of a mold in a cheese cave. And I think this is actually happening probably in many of your caves. It's just hard to see unless you're looking for it. And what I mean here is that a lot of the molds that you have in your caves as you're aging cheeses come from the natural environment, right? You're not necessarily inoculating them. They're coming from the outside world. They get into the cheese cave, and over many years, as you're producing cheese, that is a great medium for them to grow. It's also a great medium for them to evolve, right? You're creating a selective environment, just like in the Galapagos Islands, there were selective environments for Darwin's finches to evolve in different directions. And for the longest time, we've known that this has happened. We have really great evidence from looking at family trees of molds in fermented foods. So for example, Penicillium camemberti, that white mold for brie and camembert production. There's been great work in France showing that that white mold is closely related to some funkier green and blue molds that you can commonly find out in the environment. What we've not known is how did we get that white mold, right? Where did it come from? We know that someone isolated it at some point hundreds of years ago in France, but what was the process that allowed that to evolve? The same thing is true, by the way, for koji, the aspergillus mold used for soy sauce production. And for the longest time, I've had this question of, like, can we see microbial domestication happen? And again, this was not something I necessarily wrote a grant for, but fortunately, Rachel Dutton got married. And I'll tell you why that matters here. So back in 2016, I was part of a little scheme to get Rachel Dutton, my postdoc advisor, I know many of you know her, to go up to Jasper Hill in Greensboro, Vermont, so that Charlie Kalish, her now husband, could propose to her. I had no reason to go up there. I just had to get Rachel up there so Charlie can say, will you marry me? And there's the moment where it happened. They have a lovely daughter. They're happily married. It all worked out. What was great for me, for the science, is that in 2016, the way I got Rachel to go up there, I said, let's go sample Bailey. This is Bailey Hazen Blue, the blue cheese that Jasper Hill makes. And we've studied it for a long time. And Rachel was like, sure, let's go sample Bailey Hazen Blue again. I'll get in the car with you, Ben. What's cool is I took those samples from 2016 that I didn't really need. I put them in my freezer in the lab and forgot about them. And then what happened is Bailey Hazen Blue changed quite dramatically. So it used to look like this, 2016, 2017, and so on. And then around 2019, right around the pandemic, it became white. And at first we're like, maybe this is just a different mold. Maybe a new mold has come into this cave. But that's not what happened. And you may say, well, a lot happened between 2016 and 2022, Ben. The nice thing is social media exists, and we were able to scour Instagram and Facebook and other places where people had been taking pictures of Bailey when they visited Jasper Hill. And you can kind of see this beautiful transition from the green to the sort of like more dominant white mold. And this is what it looks like until today in 2026. And so for me, I was like, is this domestication? Have they evolved a new mold here? And so I had a great graduate student, Nicholas Lowe, go in and sort of do a lot of classic microbiology things. So one thing he did is he just plated out these samples that we had in the freezer and then the modern day samples. And we see that the mold here, this is a Penicillium salitum. Many of you may have this on your cheese. Did in fact exist in 2016. And it's the same mold in 2022 and 2024. It's just white. And so then the question becomes, why? Why did it turn white? What's going on here? Well, what we did is we went in with modern DNA sequencing technology, and we can go in and figure out where in the genome, the DNA of this fungus, were there changes between 2016, those early samples, and the samples we have today. And usually this kind of expedition leads to a dead end because there's a lot of DNA, and you often get regions of the genome where there's no information. But here, we were very lucky because the region of the genome that changed is this gene called ALB1. And what ALB1 is really important in, it's the first step in the production of melanin by fungi. So fungi make melanin as like essentially a sunscreen. So out in the real world, not in a cheese cave, when they're living on a plant or even the surface of soil, they need to deal with all that UV light that they're being bombarded with. And they make melanin as a way to deal with that. The coloration, the blues, the greens, the blacks that you see on molds, that is a way for them to deal with that stress. Melanin can also do some other things, but we're going to simplify and just call it sunscreen for today. And so what was happening is that gene, ALB1, was breaking. So that important step to go from white to making the melanin, it was breaking at that very first step, and it stayed white. And so we went into the genome and looked at this really carefully, and what's even cooler about what was happening in the caves of Jasper Hill is many of the mutations in this gene, so this is the gene ALB1, were being driven by something called a transposable element. You may have heard these before in sort of high school biology. They're also called jumping genes. You all have them in your genomes, and what can happen is these little pieces of DNA can pop out of one part of your genome and land in another part of the genome. And so at some point, for some reason, a bit of DNA popped out of the genome, landed in this melanin gene, and caused this mutation to happen, which is just really, really cool and really, really exciting. Again, this is just to show you, we did a whole bunch of experiments, but this is what it used to look like, and these are a variety of different strains we isolated. We even did a clean genetic knockout in the lab just to prove that if you take out this gene, you get a white mold. Okay, so you may be sitting there saying, that's really neat, but why does this matter for cheese making? And also why, right? Why would this mold do that? Well, for me, when I think about cheese caves, there's some light in there, but there's certainly not UV light, and usually the lights aren't on for a huge amount of time. It's relatively dark. And so we started thinking maybe just the dark environment, this fungus doesn't have to waste that time and energy maintaining that gene and making melanin, so it can let it and break. And so Nicholas, the PhD student involved with this, did these really beautiful experiments in the lab. I think they're just like beautiful to look at, where he took the green and the white strains and he competed them together on cheese. And he did this in the dark, and he did this with lights turned on, just to ask this question, is it really light that's driving this pattern? And what you can see here, this is the proportion. So this is just saying that who wins when we're competing them. And you notice that in the dark, the white one always wins. So that's why the white is higher here. If we turn the lights on, though, you'll notice that effect goes away. In fact, it actually flips in this condition with this strain, where the green one wins over the white one. And so we really think that this sort of loss of light in the cheese cave is one selective pressure that's driving this evolution from this sort of historical ancestral trait to this white trait. What's really neat about this is this also happens in animals. So this is not a new thing. People have been studying this for a while. You may have heard of these blind and depigmented cavefish that people have been studying for a long time, because they also have lost melanin production. They've also lost their eyes, because they don't need eyes, they don't need melanin when they're living inside of these caves. And so we think in many ways, as cheesemakers are creating these caves, as these molds are evolving, it's a lot like this longer-term evolutionary process that happens with animals. Again, really cool evolutionary biology. You still may be sitting there saying, what does this mean for cheese, Ben? Aren't we at a cheese conference? Shouldn't you tell me the practical aspect? Well, at least in the US, I suspect also in Europe, a couple of years ago, there was this sort of camembert apocalypse news thing going on that you probably got a lot of questions about. It was all sort of a PR stunt in my mind, essentially saying that the mold used for camembert production, camemberti, is going extinct. That is not true. However, it does ask the question, you know, if we're relying on just a few industrial strains of Penicillium camemberti for cheese production, is that a good thing, right? What if producers stop making those? What if there is a threat to those strains? And for me, this evolution story that is happening at Jasper Hill is a neat potential solution to that. And we actually worked with Jasper Hill to take the mold that evolved on the surface of the blue cheese, and we made a small format sort of camembert-style cheese with that mold, with that Penicillium salitum. I'll say that Jasper Hill is not making that cheese right now. That might tell you something about how successful that experiment was. It was fine. It wasn't amazing. But I think, to me, that makes it domestication, right? Where the scientist points out and says, ah, this thing is happening in your cave. The cheesemaker then takes that knowledge and tries to work with it. And this is really just the beginning, right? We're going to start looking for other strains, looking out even in the wild for other strains around Jasper Hill to see if this is the potential to develop new strains that are adapted to that particular place. And again, I don't think this is unique to Jasper Hill. I suspect that in your facilities, the same kind of evolution, even different traits, not just melanin, which for us is easy to see because it was green to white. I think flavor traits and other traits related to growth may also be evolving. They're just harder for us to see. Okay, one other thing I wanted to talk about really quickly is thinking not just about the evolution, but also we love helping cheesemakers when things fail. I know for you, it's annoying when cheese fails because that's cost and time, but for us, it's really neat microbial ecology. We begin to then try to understand what is actually changing and how can we then change that back so you get back to making great cheese. These are some of the Franken cheeses that we've been sent over the last decade to the lab. I've talked about this one before, the purple cheese. I love that one. But what I want to talk about today, since I'm a mold guy, is this right here, partly because I think this is something that should be on your radar in case you see it in your own facilities. And this is something that we've been seeing over the last 10 years in New England. I'll say it's also a problem in Brazil, and we've been recently hearing some reports about this in Europe. And what we noticed with various cheesemakers is a couple of things. One are these weird sort of cornmeal-colored poofs on the surface of the cheese, not to be confused with a much more yellow Chrysosporium mold that you see on sort of long-aged natural rinds. This is very different, much dustier, and a little bit more brown in color. And we also worked with a cheesemaker where their washed rind was disappearing. You can actually see in this picture, you know, this is typical washed rind here, and they started getting these wounds on their washed rind where literally the rind was disappearing right before their eyes. And so we went in and did our, you know, fancy sequencing and found that this is Aspergillus vesterdijkii, named after the first female professor in the Netherlands, Johanna Vesterdijk. It is a mold that can do lots of things. It can grow on salami, it can grow on coffee, it can grow on plants, it can also grow on cheese. And what is really challenging about this mold, in addition to the fact that it ruins your rinds and makes these weird poofs, it makes a ton of ochratoxin A, like the highest, one of the highest amounts that anyone's ever measured in a fungus. This is a mycotoxin that can make people sick, it can affect your kidneys, long-term exposure can actually cause cancer. So it's something you really don't want to have around in your cheese cave. And we started asking the question, you know, what is this thing, where did it come from, and how can we get rid of it? We did some DNA sequencing to create a sort of a family tree of the various isolates that we got from caves. We had an outbreak in Vermont, Massachusetts, and Connecticut in the Northeast. And this is what that family tree looks like. And what we learned from that is it's not just one clone spreading throughout New England. It's actually different genetic individuals. So here's one, here's another, and here's another that popped up over different years. So it doesn't seem like it's one introduction that's spreading throughout North America. It seems like multiple introductions from different sources. So that was a first clue of what was going on. The second thing that we did is we tried to understand, why is it messing up these rinds? Why is it causing such a detrimental effect, especially on wash rinds? When it gets in a wash rind, it really messes up the normal microbial ecology. And so this is just to show you that impact. So what we're looking at here, this is log CFU, so colony forming units. So the more you have of this, the more microbes, and this is the good microbes. And you notice in these experimental cheeses, this is a good rind density, about 9 to 10 logs. And when you have the Aspergillus present, you essentially get rid of most microbes. You're all the way down to 2 logs. This is a huge reduction. What's really interesting, we started noticing early on in the lab, that if you turn down the temperature from 20 degrees Celsius to 10 degrees Celsius, that effect goes away. So by turning down the temperature of your cheese cave, you can actually get rid of this negative effect of the Aspergillus. The reason for that is Aspergillus doesn't like it cold. So if you look at just the total Aspergillus counts, it grows quite happily at 20 degrees Celsius, which is a very warm cheese cave, 15 degrees Celsius, which is a kind of warm cheese cave, and 10 degrees, which is kind of a cool cheese cave. And at 10, it's completely gone. So the great news about this really aggressive and nasty mold is proper temperature management in your cave completely gets rid of the problem. So we've actually worked with these producers that had this problem. We've gone back after many years of them keeping their caves cooler, and we can't find the mold anymore. It's completely gone. So unlike other molds where it just kind of sticks around for a while, the nice thing is this goes away. The other thing we've been doing is working with some really fancy chemists. They can actually go in almost like a flatbed scanner, and they can use a flatbed scanner technique to look at the chemistry being produced by this fungus. And it makes an arsenal of antimicrobial compounds. One of them is penicillic acid, not penicillin. This is a different compound. And it wipes out bacteria. It wipes out yeast. So the reason those rinds are disappearing is this thing is just secreting a ton of these compounds that get rid of your good bacteria and good fungi. So again, you do not want Aspergillus vesterdijkii around, but if you do, give me a call, we can chat. Turn your cave temperature down, because that's a really great solution to this problem. A final question is, where did this thing come from, right? Why all of a sudden are we seeing it in New England? And so what we can do, compared to the many years ago when I came to the first version of this conference, we're so advanced now in the tools and resources we have. And this is a great resource called globalfungi.com, where you can literally Google the world's fungi and see where they are in the world. It's amazing. This is what I dreamed about back in 2016, and here we are today. And so we Googled Aspergillus vesterdijkii, and when you look at this map, one thing I think that's really striking is it's largely in coastal places and marine environments. There's some exceptions, right? You can see here in China. I'm skeptical. I think this is someone contaminated their lunch potentially when they were doing that work. But you'll also notice like a lot of salt production region in Australia, there's a lot of this mold around. And I think, this is a hypothesis, we have not proven this, but I think sea salt could be a vector of Aspergillus vesterdijkii. We have found other species of Aspergillus in sea salts used for cheese production. We've never found this particular one, but you could imagine just random contamination of sea salt. You get a few spores and that giant thing of sea salt that you're using for your brines or for dry salting, just a little bit of that mold and the right, you know, rise in temperature in that cave, you could lead to one of these blooms. So I think, again, I've not heard of any reports of this in the UK anywhere, but I think have this on your radar because you really want to get ahead of this thing if you have it in your cave. Okay, so that's some of our practicing and crafting. I just want to end really briefly with education. I think that we can only be useful as scientists if we can get the word out of what we do. Again, this is why this meeting is so amazing and wonderful. And again, some of the best days of my job are when I'm talking to cheese producers about microbes. So very recently, there's some folks in this room that have been at these events. We brought cheesemakers and mongers throughout New England to Tufts through a grant that we had for a two-day cheese microbiology workshop. They did all the sequencing and microscopy that we do every day in my lab. And maybe it didn't change how they sell or make their cheese, but it definitely changed the language and the perspective they have about the microbiology of their cheese. And for me, that's a win. And that was a really wonderful experience for us. And of course, we also do a lot of work to try to get this information out to the public. Bronwyn and I started microbialfoods.org, and there are other ways that we try to get this word out. And if you have ideas of things that you want to know, resources you wish you had about molds, yeast, bacteria on rinds, or other microbiology-related things, let me know, because I'm looking for some new ways to spend my time, and I'd love to help you out with that. And with that, I just want to thank the Dairy Business Innovation Center. This is a USDA-funded institution. It's really the only way I can get money these days. It's challenging in the US. And other funding agencies as well, and the amazing people in the lab. Thank you. It's we call it A West for short. Yeah.
You say, you mentioned that it doesn't grow yet at cold temperature, but following your speech about the evolution of this mold, do you think that this guy will eventually be able to develop at colder temperature?
That is the thing that keeps me up at night. Well, many things keep me up at night, but that's one of them. And so I have a PhD student that's actually doing experiments right now where she's taking that mold and trying to see if it can evolve to colder temperature tolerances, just to see if, you know, as it hangs out in a cave, even in small amounts, it might have the potential to evolve some pathway that allows it to grow in the cold. And if that happens, then we have a really big problem, because our, you know, our simple tool of temperature would no longer be effective. We have not seen any evidence yet that it's labile and can quickly evolve that cold temperature tolerance, and that, I think, is a really good thing. I think the other really good thing is that even at warmer temperatures, you're going to have a lot of penicillium molds around. You're going to have Scapulariopsis and some of those other fungi that you normally get on a natural rind. And as long as it's not taking off like it was in these three examples, I don't think it'll have large enough population sizes to really give it chances to evolve. So in evolution, you really have to have a lot of cells so that when those rare mutations pop up, they can take off and grow. And I think in a typical cheese rind environment, before this thing really takes off, it wouldn't have the opportunity to evolve. But it's something that we're thinking about. Yeah, there's a lot of research happening right now in the world of sort of microplastics and plastic pollution, looking specifically at how fungi might play a role in degrading plastics. So fungi actually are pretty good. They have weird chemistry they do. They're really good at decomposition in general, and they can break down plastic polymers and components. I'll say my one experience with plastic-coated cheeses and mold problems is this beauty right here. So this was a cheese that was wrapped in plastic after it had been aged for a little bit. And you can see this black mold here. It's Cladosporium, which many of you might have little spots of this on your natural rind sometimes. It's usually really isolated or little clusters of circles. It doesn't usually take off. But I have heard repeatedly, and I saw in this example, that if it gets in before you wrap the plastic, it loves that low oxygen environment. It loves growing under the plastic. And you know, this is actually not a safety issue because Cladosporium doesn't make toxins. It can be an allergen, but it's just an aesthetic problem, right? A lot of consumers will freak out, or distributors will freak out if you gave them this black covered cheese. So Cladosporium is a challenge. I don't know if it can break down plastic or if it's resistant to natamycin, but you know, fungi always find a way, I think, is sort of, as you can see from our evolution example. And so that is one mold that I know that can be challenging for plastic wrap cheeses. There are others, yeah. Yeah, this is the thing that I've thought a lot about. I would need to set up a completely separate lab facility because cheese mites invade fungal cultures naturally all the time. So mites are sort of out in the world, and there are many labs that had to get rid of entire fungal collections because mites get in, and once they do, it's a huge problem. So we haven't worked on it. I did dabble a little bit with this in Rachel's lab before I had my own lab in case I could mess up her lab. and what we found is they love penicillium. So all the different penicilliums that you're growing on cheddars and other cheeses, they love those. And they seem to prefer, surprisingly, even though people say they like Scopulariopsis, we actually found they didn't like them as much. But I think that trying to manage the molds to then get rid of the mites is just going to be a really huge problem. And so the physical controls of either vacuuming them off or blowing them off are really the best solutions at this time. There are some people that are thinking about the microbiome of mites, like what bacteria are living in them, and could you manipulate the microbes associated with the mites to try to use a biocontrol approach, but I haven't heard any success there. Yeah, so I think keep vacuuming and blowing them off for now. Sorry. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And two, is it an oversimplification to assume that it's ultraviolet light that is a key band? Because I'm thinking from a very practical point of view, in a lot of these cheesecakes, the only light that is in there is the fly zappers, which are using ultraviolet light.
Yeah. I love both of those questions. So the first question about flavor, there really hasn't been a change in Bailey flavor just because the rind there isn't the most important driver of flavor of that cheese, right? The vein, the blue vein, the Penicillium roqueforti is a big driver. But from sort of a sales and aesthetics perspective, Matteo and other folks at Jasper Hill love this new white mold, partly because it grows more consistently. It makes a really consistent white coat on the outside of that cheese, whereas the green version was kind of more patchy and inconsistent, and it was green, and eventually it would sort of turn gray. And so sometimes shops would be a little concerned or confused about that. This new mold, this evolved mold, really does a great job of making a rind. So they want to keep it around as long as they can. In fact, we've been sort of archiving it for them, speaking of archiving, so that if in the future their microbiology changes, we could reintroduce it and have it around for a while. In terms of, you know, using light to affect ripening, I think it's a really cool question. It's something that I want to do an experiment at Jasper Hill or somewhere else, even not necessarily with UV light, but even using different wavelengths of light, like blue versus red LEDs. We found, sort of playing around in the lab, that different cheese rind microbes are sensitive to certain wavelengths of light, and you can actually get rid of some or promote some. So I think the other thing to think about too is that some of the pigments that cheese rind microbes make are light sensitive. So like Breviobacterium linens, if you grow it in the dark, it does not turn orange. But as soon as it gets just a little bit of light, it really brightens up. So I think playing with lights in your aging facilities, you know, different wavelengths of LED lights, or even just the placement of lights, could affect ripening. I do know that in Jasper Hill, there was a change in, I think they went from incandescent to LEDs around the same time that this was happening. And we sort of anecdotally were like, maybe that's what's happening. We couldn't test that. But I do think light maybe plays a more important role than we thought in your case. So play around with that. If you want to do an experiment, let me know. I'd love to talk to you about, especially maybe with wash dryings. I think it could be really important. It's a really great question. So if you're at all concerned that you might have this in the future, there's a couple of telltale signs. For me, the presentation I see the most is sort of this poofs that are like these brownish, I call it cornmeal. There might be a better way to describe that. Growing sort of on top of or with other molds. Again, the only other fungus that would do that on a cheese rind is that Chrysosporium that you often see some of in French cheeses, but that's a much more sort of highlighter yellow, really bright intensity yellow, and not as, this is really soft and dusty. But the challenge is it presents differently on different cheeses. So on a washed rind, I've never seen that. What I see on washed rinds is more of this sort of wound formation. You'll also notice on this washed rind, see these sort of like black wrinkles that are forming that almost looks like geo on an ashed bloomy rind cheese. But that is the aspergillus causing that formation. You wouldn't normally see black wrinkles on a washed rind. We've seen this repeatedly with aspergillus. The final presentation is sometimes it looks like this, which is on a block cheddar, where it's like black and flaky. And many aspergilli, if they grow on a cheese, will make this. Some of you may have seen this before. It can be confused with mucor, which can also present sort of this black, flaky appearance. But I usually don't see mucor on these long-aged cheddars, but I do see aspergillus. So these three pictures, I think, are the best representation of it. I'm working right now on a webinar that'll be up soon as part of this grant that's going to talk about sort of practical ID of this mold, and I'm happy to send it to Bronwyn so she can send it out to conference participants. So that'd be useful, because I think sort of macroscopically, if you could get ahead of it before it becomes a problem, that'd be great. Yeah. Hi.
Great job. Talk about archiving a little bit. What are the resources available, and is there a value in archiving our microbes for our species?
Yeah, I mean, for that evolution story, right, that was accidental archiving, just me not liking to throw things away, which is, I think, a good thing. But more intentional...
Yeah, like number of freezers are increasing.
Exactly. And we're running out of space in ours. I think this is a great question. I also think something that came up with that Jasper Hill evolution story was, you know, who owns that mold now? Like, it evolved naturally in that environment. Whose mold is that? Is it Jasper Hill's? Could someone else isolate that and start using that for cheese production? And sort of questions of ownership and archiving, I think, are in some ways a little bit linked. I don't have a great answer for that for food microbes in the U.S. right now. I don't know. Probably in France there's a great system for doing that, in other parts of the world. But there's a conversation happening about, with climate change, with changing food systems, with, you know, new microbes showing up and changing the microbial ecology, should we be better at archiving for the future? I know Jasper Hill is really kind of cutting edge with this. They have their own minus 80 freezer that they take certain strains and keep on hand in case they need them in the future. But that's obviously not something that everyone can do. You need the expertise. And so thinking about investing in or writing grants for resources to do that, I think, is a really great idea.
I think we need to move on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah.